And now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Cecilia from La Mesa.
Hello, my name is Cecilia, and I am an alcoholic. Wow. I'd like to thank Christina for asking me to speak. I'd like to welcome the newcomers, our visitors, and congratulate all the token takers, the birthday people. My sobriety date is February 16th, 1995. My home group is East Lake Greens Attitude Adjustment Meeting. We meet Saturday mornings, 7 a.m. And I grew up and got sober in the South Bay, and that I'm still tied there. I grew up in a family where, you know, there was drinking, just like what Alex shared. And thank you, Alex, for your 10 minutes, and happy birthday. To me, it was normal. I know that, for example, for Christmas, you know, we'd all go to midnight mass. And I remember one year, there was a couple guys that came in, you know, in the Navy, and they had this woman with them, and they were all really drunk, you know. And, you know, we all sat there and looked at them like, oh, my God, you know. Because at least my family, we waited till after midnight mass to break out the bottles, you know, and tie one on till 5 in the morning, you know. And that was Christmas every year. That's how it went. Living in San Diego, we had a lot of family that lived in L.A. And whenever they went back and forth to Sonora, which is where my parents are from, they'd stop off at our house. And out came the bottles. And it was the men around the dining room table and the women in the living room, and there was, you know, the shot glasses and the beer and the wine over here, and all of us little kids just took turns, you know, and we went around and, you know, learned how to be really sneaky and drink a little bit out of everybody's cup, and then go outside and spin around, and, you know, it was fun. And the same with the weddings, lots of family weddings. I got tons of cousins. And we did the same thing. All the adults would get up to dance, and we'd drink all their drinks, you know. And then, like, I think one of my cousins invented break dancing way before they came out, because he'd be out there, you know, and they'd be like, what's wrong with him, you know? Well, we knew. I grew up like a real anxious kid. I was always, you know, kind of wondering when that next thing was going to happen. I'm the seventh of eight children. My older brothers and sisters were in their teens when I was born, and my two older brothers left for Vietnam when I was like 5 or 6, and I didn't know where they'd gone. You know, they're just gone, you know. And same when my sisters got married, they just weren't there anymore. And kind of felt like a little mushroom. And for me, I kept it all inside, you know. I also had a neurological disorder growing up. I would have grand mal seizures. And my family thought that if they could keep me from reacting to things, you know, kind of tamp down on my theatrical nature, that that would keep me from having a seizure. So, and that was like the way they described me. I was either going to be an actress, because I was so dramatic, or a lawyer, because I would argue until I was blue in the face with all of them. When you're seventh of eight kids, you got to stand your ground. So for me, I didn't know this, but I used to take a little pill for this condition, and I found out later that this was phenobarbital. And so I was pretty checked out as a little kid. You know, and used to come home and take my little pill and sit down in front of the TV and watch Dark Shadows and just kind of lived up in my head, you know, and it's like, wow. You know, and I did. I lived a lot up in my head. I can remember stealing my first beer from my dad's ice chest. You know, he'd be outside mowing the lawn, and, you know, his little reward was his ice chest with his beer. I was about 8 years old, and I took the beer and I drank it. And I have a granddaughter now that's 8 years old, and I can't imagine, you know, her at that age wanting to take somebody's beer and drink it. But to me, that was the thing to do. I mean, that was, I loved alcohol. I loved the way it tastes. I loved how it tastes out of a shot glass, out of a beer bottle, out of a wine glass. Didn't matter. And I loved what it did for me. Because like someone else I know mentions, it turned that prickly inside of me into black velvet. You know, I just like calm right on down. And I could enjoy. And I grew up in a house where it basically was geared towards adults, you know, and I had big ears because that's the only way I could figure out what was going on. And when my brothers came home from Vietnam, you know, the three oldest of them would sit around and talk about not just their experiences, you know, in the service, but the wine, women, and song. And I figured I need to know this stuff. So I can remember one time my mom looking for me, and, you know, she only spoke Spanish. She's like, ¿Dónde está Cecilia? I'm underneath the dining room table. There's a long tablecloth. And I'm under there listening to my brothers. Because I figure I need to know how they think. Because I knew how I thought and how my older sisters thought, how my mom thought. And I used to think, God, is that how you think? But I figured forewarned is forearmed. And I was always a good student. I read a lot. By the time I got to junior high, I was really active in school. I played the flute. I was in band. It was cool then to be in band, not in high school. And I can remember before a concert at night, we'd all go across the street into the alley and get motivated, which, if you don't know, in Spanish, mota is pot. So we'd be over there smoking, come back and do our concert, and we'd be really cool, you know, all we needed was the sunglasses and playing the music and feeling it, and wow, you know, for me that was great. But at the same time, I had to be real careful who I drank or used around, because, you know, my older brothers and sisters were all good students, and I was expected, you know, to follow along and do the same. And, you know, by the time I was in ninth grade, I was getting straight A's, and I was involved in every club I could find, bored to death, and I'm smoking and drinking with the neighborhood kids. And that year, something fabulous happened. All three of my brothers all got married, and they'd all stayed in the house up until then, so they were gone. So then I could really start to party. And when I got to high school, I kind of slowed down a little bit for a while, and I just kind of became a weekend participant. School was really important to me, and, you know, being a younger kid in a big family, it's kind of like the way I got noticed and what I could do, you know, for my parents to be proud of me. You know, especially my dad. I was daddy's little girl, and I wanted him to be proud of me. So I did my schoolwork, and I did what I was supposed to do. But then I had this crazy side to me. And I think one of the craziest things I did in high school was me and my girlfriend, I was a strong swimmer, and we decided to go out into a Mission Beach with our boogie boards during a storm surge. And this is like around April or May, or I don't know, it must have been early in the winter, like maybe February. And decided that, okay, we're gonna boogie board these waves. And instead of waiting till after we got out to light up, we did it before. So we're in the ocean, and I'm trying to ride this wave, and I'm not right all there. And I get tossed around, and my head slams down to the bottom of the ocean. And luckily, I stood up, and staggered out and thought, wow, what a ride. You know, and that was just, that's that feeling of, you know, invincibility. Like, I can do anything. And it's never going to affect me, and I can live like this till I'm 85 years old, in my little rocker, doing my thing, and, you know, life will be great. And that's how I was planning it. When I graduated high school, I was accepted to some major universities. I had teachers that really believed in me and told me I could shoot for the stars, and I did. And I got into Yale, along with a few others, but that's the one I chose. So I went to Yale University at 17. I turned 18 when I was there. Got on the plane and had a couple stops in L.A. and Chicago and finally made it to JFK and drank the whole way. And luckily, I got met by one of my cousins that was in New York doing an internship, you know, and I come off the plane, and there's my cousin Mario, and he's like, okay, you know, he knew what was up, and, you know, and then it was on. You know, I'm away from home. The drinking age is 18, which, so what, you know, it's like, and the way that the university did it, they had these social activities committees, and every weekend they made sure they had parties for all the students, and the beer and the wine and everything would be stacked yay high, you know. That's how it was done. And I was a student maybe Monday through Thursday, and Thursday night through Sunday afternoon I partied. And I met a lot of people out there. I made a lot of friends. I would go home with them to wherever they were from on the, you know, East Coast, whether New York or Boston. I just, you know, got to do all this stuff. And I was this young girl, and this was really important to me. And it's like Bill says in the book, you know, in his first chapter, you know, I had arrived. But I also kept falling in love and getting involved with these guys. You know, it started to major in boyfriend. And you know, one I almost married at 18. You know, he wanted to get married, and I said, sure. The next one, you know, I decided, okay, I'm going to move off campus, and I'm going to rent a place, and we're going to have our own little love nest. And but it turned out he broke up with me, and I was like, well, you could have broke up with me during the summer before I signed the lease. But I just went ahead and stuck it out that semester, and then just got really disenchanted with the whole experience. I was like, what am I doing here? I don't really even like it here. I was working in the admissions office, and I could hear people come in and kind of broker admissions for students. You know, well, my client will donate $40,000 to the Yale Art Fund. You know, I'm sure we can find a place for that kid in the class. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, here I am struggling and trying to prove myself because I'm a minority, and everybody's saying I only got in because of affirmative action, and I'm busting my butt for my grades, and it just didn't mean anything anymore. And I withdrew, and I came home, and didn't even finish that semester. And I kept going to school. I went right to Southwestern, which was interesting, and then right into state, and kept it up. You know, my dream was to get my BA and to become a teacher and on and on. But in the meantime, my brother got sick. My dad got sick. I'd met someone else. And I just burned out. And I quit school. And about that time is when I turned the corner with the drinking. Because I just couldn't face the fact that I had failed. And I wasn't going to finish school, and I wasn't going to graduate, and la, 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 you know. And I'm just filled with anger at myself and self-pity. And I had started to drink at me, and I just, me and my sister would, you know, go to the movies and, you know, get drunk or stoned and just hang out. And I'm just like, what am I doing? And the boyfriend asked me to marry him. And the first time he asked, I'd had a hard day at work, and I was at home. I'd gotten home and to my little apartment. I'd gotten drunk, and I looked at him like, "You're crazy." And the second time, I thought, "Well, maybe he's got something here, you know. Maybe I should." And so I did. And I loved him. I loved him, but I gave up. I gave up my dream, to be, what I thought he wanted me to be. And the drinking just got worse. I got pregnant right away with my first son. He was working in space divisions back when the Challenger blew up. And I knew, okay, there goes the job. And sure enough, he got laid off. Heads roll when stuff like that happens. And I did what I always do, or what I always did, which is just kind of bear down on it and just not talk about it and feel all these feelings and not express them. Because growing up in a house where there's a lot of drinking, you don't talk about it, you don't feel your feelings, or like for me, this is true, and you don't share, just that this is incredible stoicism, like, ugh, I just have to do this. And that's how I just did life. There wasn't a lot of joy in my life anymore. And within 3 years, 7 years, I had my three children. And the last 5 years of my drinking, I was in a cycle that was incredibly vicious because I tried to control it always tried to control my drinking. And I would drink for 3 weeks, and life would start unraveling, so then I'd stop, and then I'd switch to the smokable stuff, and stuff would get worse. So I'd stop that, and then I would just white-knuckle it. And these would last like 3 weeks apiece, And I cycled that way for the last 5 years. And I was able to stop for the pregnancies, and that always gave me hope. I thought, okay, I've got this licked. I can stop for the baby. I'll be good afterwards. No problem. I won't have this drinking problem anymore. And the last time I did that, my youngest son was 5 months old. And it was hard because my husband at the time was living away from the house, working in L.A. because that's where he could find work. And I had these two. I had a 7-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a newborn. And I was scared to death, and I'm trying to do it, and I'm trying to be brave and keep it all together. And I had to stop breastfeeding that baby because I had to drink. There was just no question. I just had to drink. And I broke my own heart. I was like, you can't do this. You can't do this. And I thought with this last pregnancy, like, this is it. I'm so healthy. We're walking every day. I got this, and I didn't. And that was January of 94. And I remember getting on the floor in my bedroom and praying on my face, just laid out on the floor and just praying and just saying, God, you've got to help me. I knew I was defeated. I knew I couldn't stop drinking by myself. I tried my controlled drinking for 5 years. I almost went insane with that. And here I am with the best intentions, of a young mother, and I can't stop. So the idea came into my head of AA, and I actually felt 20 minutes of peace. And so I came into the program, but also went in through Kaiser CDRP program. And that was kind of weird. But in AA, I came in and I did almost 10 months, and then I relapsed. And that's why, February of 95, I got sober, and I've been sober since. But I remember just being really scared of all of you, because I was raised a certain way, and my bottom didn't look like yours. I still had a family. I had, a marriage, a house, kids, all this stuff. But what I did know, and I didn't know it at the time, but I could see my yets. I knew if I continued the way I was going. It's like the acronym says, you're eligible too. And so I would say the first 4 years of my sobriety, I was just basically kind of like just undrunk because I was so scared to work the steps. I was terrified of that fourth step. I said, no way am I going to do that and share it with anybody. And it had to get painful enough, not drinking, you know, stark raving sober, for me to do it. And on top of that, I the first 4 years of my sobriety, within the first 2 years, I got diagnosed with a chronic pain condition. I got a wonderful psychiatric diagnosis, and my dad died. And I lost, I miscarried a child. And it was like, I was pissed off at God. It's like, why did you do this to me? Why am I sober to have all this happen to me? I was pissed. So for me, you know, that's where the rubber hit the road. I had to just, okay, you got to work these steps now. And I did the best I could. In the fourth step, finally, I couldn't go real deep, and I think I was still doing a lot of this, you know, finger pointing outwards, you know, it's all your fault. And I was still a lot into, like, look what you've done to me. And that didn't fly too well with my sponsors and with the women, older women in the program that I hung out with, that I followed, that I, you know, that mentored me. But it was the best I could do. And after my dad died, I kept trying to reach out to my husband for comfort. But my dad and his mom both died within 13 months of each other. And he wasn't there. And it got to where he started telling me, I'm indifferent to you. And I'm like, well, I love you. But I realized I couldn't stay in that marriage. And I was 7 years sober. And the last 2 years, scared to death. We're going to a counselor. You know, he's saying stuff like, I don't know why we're here, Cecilia. You're the one with the problem. And I'm like, well, I'm going to get rid of my problem pretty quick here. And I got real, you know, and I got real rebellious about it, really angry. And I was like, okay, you know, here, you know. And it was like, okay, so I asked him for a divorce. And everything was going along so and so. Until we'd gotten to where we're, you know, we mediated the divorce with one lawyer. Everything was okay. But within a few months of that, one of the hardest things in my life happened. And that was my oldest son tried to commit suicide in our garage. And he hung himself. And he told me later, and he survived, he told me later that he started to feel, you know, the presence of God. You know, and I firmly believe him. And he said he felt himself slipping away. But he was also told, it's not your time. And you've got to breathe. And so he did. And he was actually able to pull himself down off of that beam. And spent 3 days in the ICU. Because they were afraid his trach was going to collapse, and then that would have been it too. And my world just shattered. I didn't know which way was up or down, and I felt so much guilt. Because if I hadn't tried to divorce his dad, you know, oh, it's all my fault. And that's all I could do for like 2 years. I just kind of went away, and my kids kind of took care of themselves. They started calling themselves the Three Musketeers. Because mom was checked out. I was still sober, and I was making it every day by going to 3 meetings a day. And I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I did more inventory and did my steps again and just kept moving along. And what I realized today, you know, for a long time I felt that guilt about my son, but what I realized today is that he made that choice to live, and that he came back that day, and that that's, you know, he was reborn, you know, and he's doing well today. But that guilt was to the point where, you know, I never thought getting sober, I'd have to live with so much of that guilt and pain. But God's good, and God is, you know, in We Agnostics, it talks about God is or isn't. Well, God is. So by doing inventory, you know, more and more inventory, I was able to really get to my part in my resentments. And I was a resentful woman. I mean, I was angry with God, you know, angry for all these things that had happened. I couldn't see the grace in it. I couldn't see any opportunity for growth. You know, I was just, you know, I'm a rebellious alcoholic. And that's all I could do and be. And through resentment and through, you know, prayer and through the prayer of others, the support of other people, I started coming out of it. And one thing I learned is, you know, in the fourth step, it's not just resentments that that's a problem. It's a fact that I would give my power to the people I was resentful at instead of allowing God to be my source, you know, to be that sunlight of the Spirit for me. I cared way too much what you did and what you said and all of it, rather than allowing myself to be led and molded by God. And I had to get into a much deeper level of spirituality to survive all of this. And I, you know, and it's only through God's grace. You know, I realized for the longest time, I tried to do this program mentally. Like, my sick mind is going to fix this problem, you know. And it's like that saying by Einstein, a problem cannot be solved at the level at which it was created. So, hello, you know, you're sick, honey. And this is not going to go away, and it's not going to change by you willing it. You know, I had to find a deeper spirituality. And it started to happen. I started working in special education. I'm a technician. I'm in a classroom with the teacher. I work with the kids. And I chose that because I was so impressed with what the teachers were able to do with my son, you know, to help him come back, you know, from his attempt and to get on with his high schooling and, you know, to, you know, he ended up getting his GED and moving on. And I was just so impressed with what those teachers did that I wanted to give back. And by going into that field, I grew in patience and compassion and tolerance, because I started working with children that are severely autistic, that don't speak, that everything, if they can't communicate and you can't read their cues when they're trying to communicate at a certain level, it elevates into kicking, biting, scratching, screaming, you know, throwing, and and there I am in the middle of it. And it taught me so much about myself, because inside I was as broken as those kids, you know. It taught me about compassion. You know, I went through life like, you know, that bull in the china shop, just trying to make you do what I thought you're supposed to do, especially with my kids. Like, I'm the mom, you know. I used to tell them, you know, growing up, I thought it was so cute. I used to tell them, they complain about how strict I was. And I tell them, I'm one of the founding members of the Mean Mom Club. Oh. And then, you know, and I was like, that's how I was raised. You know, just kind of got squished on and, you know, pushed down and all that stuff just stayed inside. And that's how I was doing it with them. And doing this kind of work opened me up. I continued to work steps to sponsor people. But it was one of those things where they weren't staying sober. And I would try, and I just didn't. I thought it was me. And it, you know, I can't make people be willing. And it was heartbreaking at times to watch people not make it. And going on 12-step calls with other more sober women, with these other young mothers, you know, that just couldn't get sober, and watching the progression, and watching how all the things that I saw were my yets were happening in their lives, you know, and they were losing things and husbands and their dignity and, you know, and I'm just like, all of this started to teach me just how blessed I am and how grateful I really am. The fact that I was able to be a part of that. I've always been someone that listens. You know, I listen really deeply, and I learned how to just take cues from what was going on around me, and learn from it. So, in other words, the steps were starting to work in my life, and. Okay, good. I want to go ahead and get going with this. It's quick. The thing is, there was still part of me that I couldn't seem to get in touch with. There was still part of me that was still really hard on myself. You know, I could hear people tell me, you know, wow, you're growing, look at you, this and that. And there was part of me that's still just so hard on myself. And I always would, like, wonder, why do I hate myself? Why do I have this part that's just so negating of the beauty that I am as a human being, you know, as one of God's children? What's there, you know? Why am I so hard on myself? Why, you know, I'd have anyone who got to know me just within, you know, why are you so hard on yourself? I don't know. Well, and this is a big part and a big key to my recovery, I found out. And I recovered a memory in December of 2009, and that was of incest abuse. One of my older brothers, that it only stopped because he went to Vietnam. And I knew, but I didn't want to know. And when my father had died, it had come out that he'd abused his own children. And he was actually sitting in prison for it. And I still, you know, there's a part of the mind that, unless you're ready, at least for me, I couldn't know until I knew. And that day, you know, December 1st, 2009, it came to me. And it was just surreal. And I just started remembering stuff. And I said, okay, stay with it. Don't shut down. Just feel it. And it all came. And what it did for me was set me free. Because there it was. You know, I took on his shame and his guilt. I took on, you know, basically, I was paying, you know, all that time in my life for something that had been done to me, you know. And I, at that time, one of my granddaughters was only 4 years old. And that probably played a part in it, because I would look at her before I remembered. I'd look at her, what an innocent, beautiful little girl. And when I remembered, it's like I was that same innocent, beautiful little girl that she is now when that happened to me. And I completely buried it. And, you know, there were other occasions in my life of molestation and rape. And, you know, those things happened in my life. But I never knew how far back it went or how much I'd covered up. And that was like the key I needed at that point to get really rocketed into the fourth dimension. Incredible. I was just like free. And the love I felt for myself was amazing. I just like, wow, you know, this all is true and this works and I'm free of it. I'd gotten down to the very core of that onion and there was just freedom. And that's that onion I was afraid to peel 4 years sober by doing my fourth step. And that brother, I'd done inventory on him already in my life. And I had done inventory about him and what he'd done to my goddaughter, because one of his daughters was my goddaughter. And I came to the conclusion that I'm not going to hold on to this if I've already worked it out because of her. You know, I'm not going to hold on to this because it's me now. And last April, actually the 9th of April, my mother passed away from dementia. And when she was at the point where she was going to die, and I told my brothers and sisters, we've got to get him on the phone. You know, we've got to contact the chaplain and we've got to get him on the phone so he can say goodbye so she can go. And we did, and I heard his voice, and it brought back a lot of memories, but he was a trooper, and he said, you know, I'll see you in heaven, Mama, in Spanish, and he's telling her all these things, and she was able to pass. And I was grateful for what he did. And in December this last year, the church where I go to services, they did an outreach to people in prison. And I thought, okay, well, I'll write cards to people, to men in prison. And, you know, I don't write my own name. I just, you know, wishing them well and, you know, telling Jesus loves you, whatever, you know. And part of me was like, well, here you're reaching out to these people you don't even know. And you have a brother, you know, in prison. Why don't you write a card to him too? And I did. I did. And I told him, thank you for letting our mom die peacefully. And I told him, you know, I appreciate what you've done. And I let him know that I loved him. And that right there was one of the most healing things I've ever done in my life. And I'm opened up. I'm way wide open now. It's like nothing holds me back. You know, when I feel something, I really feel it. If I feel happy, I'm happy. If I'm sad, I'm sad. It's like all those reasons for drinking, you know, they're not there. I've lived sober through some pretty hard stuff. You know, this last year with my mom passing, at the same time, I chose to sell my house. I was upside down in my house. My two youngest kids, my daughter finished at her junior college. She transferred to college in L.A. My youngest son finished high school. He transferred. I moved out of the house where I'd raised him for 22 years. And that all happened within 2 months. Losing my mom, the two kids leaving, selling the house. And it's like, sometimes it gets like that in my life. And I just went ahead and walked right through it. And it was hard. And I remember just staying really busy. But at the same time, I was turning 50 that summer. So I was like, okay, let's party. And me and my friends did a lot of fun stuff for our 50th birthdays. And I've just continued to show myself that I can get through a lot of things. My life today is wonderful. I sponsor. I'm of service, mostly in my home group and in meetings. I'm not necessarily in service at a level beyond the group. And I'm just really a joyful person. I am so amazed at what life is, you know, and what and who God is. God is inside. God's like this little power plant in my heart that lights up my day. And that, you know, this story I'm sharing with you is just stuff that happened, you know. I'm not my story, you know. I've grown beyond it, you know. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous work. And I invite everyone here, you know, to work them. And whether you're brand new or you haven't done them in a while, it doesn't matter. When I do step work, when I do inventory, I just go deeper and deeper into the heart of God. And there's nothing there anymore that I'm scared of. This week, I was doing my fourth step again. And I'm like, wow, here I am. And when I do a fourth step now, there's no fear left. It's more like, okay, let's get this out because I want to give it to God and feel more joy and more freedom and have more for in my life and to give out to others. So that's what I have to share with you. Thank you, and I love you.